beautiful music that I am pretty sure I can guarantee you have not heard before, and I'm betting you cannot guess who wrote it or what it's from. That's because it is Ophelia's Funeral March from the opera Amleto by Franco Facio, with a libretto, though you didn't hear the libretto directly, there by Arrigo Boito. It was the first Shakespearean opera, a Hamlet setting, with a libretto by Boito, who of course went on to write the libretti for Otello and Falstaff and make the world of opera very different and the world of dramatic opera and adaptation of Shakespeare very different with Giuseppe Verdi. In fact, Otello was premiered by the composer of that opera, a young man from Italy named Franco Facio, who that was only his second opera, and it was his last opera for a number of reasons. And that performance, which even though we don't know the work, I can say sounds very idiomatic, sounds like it's an opera from 1865, was conducted there by our guest today, who rediscovered, reconstructed, edited, and conducted there the Dallas Opera Orchestra in that excerpt from Amleto of Facio, the Funeral March of Ophelia. And I'm speaking of and with Anthony Barese. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
You are from Chicago. You are a conductor, you are a composer, and I think we can now officially say you're also a musicologist.
Yeah.
Because you've been doing a lot of detective work, and we want to talk with you about all three of your careers, both as a means of sharing some very fascinating things and a fascinating person with our listeners, but also to remind people that, yes, Chicago is home of all kinds of wonderful musicians and all kinds of wonderful composers, but there's also bubbling just below the surface oftentimes a cadre now of very fine young conductors. And we've had on this program Alexander Platt of Chicago Opera Theater. You've also heard Francesco Milito of a number of groups here in Chicago, Mina Zikri of the Oistrakh Symphony Orchestra and DePaul, and there are others too to be discovered. But this is a fascinating world because very often people are unknown in their own hometowns, even if they've got great credits in Europe and in Dallas and in Albuquerque and in Sarasota, as is the case with Anthony Barese. So we'll come to your biography in a bit, but let's talk a bit about just the project that you're engaged with Facio and Amleto.
Well, like as you said, this libretto is by Boito. It was his first Shakespeare libretto. It was also his first libretto of anything. Mm-hmm. And I became interested in the project. Somebody told me that he had written a Hamlet adaptation. And since Hamlet was my favorite Shakespeare opera, I thought I have to get a copy of this. So I wrote
Hamlet was your favorite Shakespeare play or your favorite Shakespeare opera?
Sorry, Shakespeare play,
it's okay. Maybe you're really wild about that. André Thomas or whatever it is.
Hardly. So I basically wrote to everybody I knew to try and find a copy of this, and it was premiered in 1865, and it was a pretty decent success. But then Boito and Facio joined Garibaldi's army, and they went off, you know, doing their thing throughout Europe. In the meantime, Facio heard more Wagner. He discovered more Beethoven. He got a more Germanic influence. He came back, and for the La Scala remount of this piece in 1871, he incorporated a lot of the stuff he had heard in Germany. Mm-hmm. And the Scala performance was a famous disaster. It was the tenor got sick. They had to postpone opening night. The tenor kept getting, you know, he was sick for opening night. It was a huge, huge disaster. They pulled it after one performance and he just quit composition entirely and went on to have a very notable career as a conductor.
Introducing Wagner. Introducing, Italy, I believe.
Yeah, Lohengrin. Yes. Well, he did conduct Lohengrin, but I don't think he was the first one to do it. But he was
in Italy. He was not.
Oh, I don't believe. I don't believe so. But I know he was a huge part of the thing that he and Boito were. They were part of the Scapigliatura group of young composers who were trying to bring the music of the future to Italy,
right.
And they were very in their kind of aesthetic. They thought they were very anti-Verdi and pro-Wagner, but hearing the Funeral March, it's completely Mediterranean through and through. There's very little of that's Wagnerian in it. So after this piece died in 1871, he never had it done ever again. It was such a disaster that Ricordi, contrary to their usual procedure, they didn't even make a piano vocal score of it. And even operas that were just done once, Ricordi prints a piano vocal score of. So the only chance I had with this was to get a copy of the manuscript. And luckily, Gabriele Dotto, who's an American working in Italian, who was with Ricordi at the time, who I met through a friend, through a friend, through a friend, he said, we have a microfilm of this opera, so we can send it to you. You know, they did that. I basically lived in my parents' basement for about a year and a half with a microscope and a ruler and a pencil, and I transcribed out every single note of this thing. And then I spent a summer in Milan the next summer going over the actual autograph with it and kind of coming up with this edition of it, and then after doing that making a piano vocal score of it and shopping it out to everybody I possibly could.
And you were able even, I think, to get the first performance rights.
I was able to get the first performance rights after a point. You know, it was funny. I kept saying to Ricordi, can you generate some interest in this?
Yeah.
I mean, people are doing kind of anything these days.
Right.
And they said, no. And then out of the blue, Alagna did a radio interview somewhere.
Roberto Alagna.
Yes. Roberto Alagna did a radio interview somewhere, in, I think it was in France, and mentioned this piece. And he said, I'm really kind of interested in this. Out of nowhere, Ricordi writes me and says, we really need to buy you out of these rights right now. You know, and it was one of these things. They weren't returning my phone calls for months or emails,
yeah,
nothing.
And all of a sudden,
we need
to
do this now. They called me. It was all right, you know. And at this point, I had shopped this piece around to everybody I knew. And I just said, just take it. Just pay me my whatever and just
take
it.
Why didn't you tell them that Alagna could do it, but you had to conduct?
Well, I kind of said that when I first went over there. I said, I want to have these rights, but I want to be, you know, and I had no idea what I was doing. I said, I want to be the one to conduct this. And they kind of, you know, smiled and patted me on the head. This is before my career really took off. I would love to conduct it, but at the same time, I just really want to hear the piece.
So is there a plan that for
Alagna? Nothing
definite.
You know,
this?
There's always talk.
Yeah.
Domingo was interested in it for a while, but
right.
I think that kind of cooled off.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, you know, when I was an assistant conductor in Dallas, I just said I really want to get some of this out there.
Right. Right.
And actually, the funny thing about that piece that you played is there's nothing really very well known from this opera. If there's anything, it's that.
Right.
Because bizarrely enough, the island of Corfu off the coast of Greece has this Good Friday tradition. Every Good Friday, they play their municipal band plays that piece.
Oh, I knew that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Who doesn't know? So I'm getting emails from people in Corfu going, you know, will you come down and speak? This is our national treasure.
Do you think there just happened to be a conductor who had been a Faccio student who passed through there? Because Faccio it was a brief career, but it was a very important conducting career.
Yeah, I have no idea because they don't have an opera house. They have a conservatory. It's just one of these things that is attached to the local, you know, it's very kind of like a...
Wow. Well, have you gone to Corfu yet?
No, I'm kind of...
You're going to be a hero there.
It's kind of strange,
except
yeah.
if you give them the new edition, the band members might get upset.
Well, you know,
this is where the euphonium comes in, buddy, and that's it.
Well, it's funny you should say that. You go to YouTube and you search Corfu and Amleta, you come up with like 7 videos of their band doing this with like, you know, 20 sarusophones and trumpets, and they do it in about like... half the tempo.
It's
crazy. It's really interesting. Yeah. It's very funny.
Now, with all the interest that there is in music scholarship, with all the interest that there is now, thanks to the work of Philip Gossett here in Chicago and those in his Italian opera project literally around the world, why is it that nobody had tried to look for Amleto, or they had looked and just given up?
I don't really know. I mean, it's funny you should mention Philip. Philip's a good friend of mine, and he was extremely – he's the one that actually got me in touch with Gabriele Dotto.
Mm-hmm.
He looked over the manuscript with me. He was very supportive, and I think
– And he's – you know, it's – with Philip Gossett, you have to know what you're doing, and you
absolutely.
Have to have real manuscripts, and you have to – he is extremely exacting.
He's very exacting, and I think he realized that I'm not a musicologist. I'm a composer and conductor, but he was very supportive of the work that I did, and I think there's just so many reasons. This is a completely unknown piece. I mean, Boito can only bring people so far, you know. Philip was incredibly supportive. I think the problem with this piece is it's such an unknown entity. People really don't want to take a chance on this unless you get someone like Domingo or Alagna really on board with it.
Right. But certainly Domingo is perhaps not an example because he's a unique case, but he has gotten people interested in operas that have not been done otherwise.
Right.
Franey did the same with Fedora, which mm-hmm. was at least a more known work, but still
right.
a lesser work and a lesser known work. Now that you're done with the editing and hearing it in your mind and having mm-hmm. played some excerpts, where do you see the work fitting in musical historically? We know where it fits in with Boito, mm-hmm. but where do you see it standing? I know that the proof will be in the performances and so on, but do you have a sense of where it fits in either in the, quote, history of Western music or where it might stand if it were to be adopted?
I do, because Faccio also importantly conducted the premiere of Puccini's second opera, Edgar.
Right. And I think of a version of his first opera, right?
Livilli. I think it was the right. second version of that,
right.
yes. And the thing that is, you can see, that is very markedly distinct from Verdi and looking forward to Wagner in his work is in the orchestration, mm-hmm. especially if you look at, I think it's the opening of the I believe it's the opening of the third act. It's very much like Lohengrin. You have this D major section with very, very high string harmonics. And you also have very subtle effects of cymbals, pianissimo, things that, mm-hmm. you know, very, very kind of colorful thinking in, with the orchestra that you don't really see in Verdi until much later. And so
right.
I do think if there is a bridge, that's the bridge it makes. Because
right.
going from Verdi, you have the kind of trovatore orchestra, and then by the time you get to Aida and even into Otello and Falstaff, you have a very different thinking about the orchestra.
Right.
And I'm not sure that Verdi ever heard this piece, but it was done in Genoa, and it was a huge success mm-hmm. in Genoa.
It would be very interesting now and in the next few years as we are getting professional performances finally, some in concert version, some staged, of those early Puccini works because
right.
we're getting more of an understanding, one, of that bridge period,
mm-hmm.
and two, for those who have poo-pooed Puccini, mostly because they haven't really listened, this sense that German music and that Wagner and so on had such an influence and what a master orchestrator
right.
Puccini was. And whatever else one thinks of sentimentality or theatrical effect or boulevard or something in the stories and the libretti, I mean, I was talking recently with Riccardo Muti, and in passing for other reasons, we're talking about Puccini. And, you know, he was saying, you just don't know these works until you really look at them and see what a serious composer.
Absolutely.
Doesn't need to be your favorite, but
no.
so serious.
You can't
you know?
Say Puccini is not a serious composer if you have looked at any one of his scores.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the attention to detail alone is masterful, and it surpasses kind of anything else that was going on in Italy at the time.
Well, we're talking about Puccini, we're talking about Italy, we're talking about studying scores, we're talking about masters. So we're really going to set you up here now, Tony, because we're going to listen to an excerpt of one of the greatest recordings of Puccini of all time by one of the greatest conductors of all time. But we're going to listen to it because it's something that influenced you, my guess is probably originally as a kid, but has continued to influence you as somebody who cares about conducting and cares about conducting opera.
Quella gente che dirà.
Mi muove la bile,
mi muove la bile.
Leach Albanese, Jan Pierce, Francesco Valentino, Anne McKnight and company, Arturo Toscanini, conducting the NBC Symphony Orchestra live NBC broadcasts of February 3rd and 10, 1946, Puccini's Bohème. And we are playing that here on Critical Thinking on 98.7 WFMT in Chicago and WFMT.com, streaming and podcasting, because, well, one, it's just great, and so you can play it as often as you want, but also because I think it gives us some additional insight into our guest, Anthony Barese, Chicago conductor, who will be talking now about more about his conducting career, but because you're willing to say that something is the gold standard and that you might learn something not by being imitative of it, but being inspired or maybe even chastened by it?
I think so, because the first Bohème was the first opera I fell in love with. It was the first opera I ever conducted. And growing up, I listened to the famous Carrion recording of it and loved it, and not realizing that what I really loved about it was Pavarotti, because he was my favorite singer, still is my favorite singer. And I just really grew very, very attached to that opera, that recording of that opera. And when I started to really delve into the opera and, you know, learning about it to conduct it, a friend of mine said, "You know the Toscanini recording?" And I, you know, I was 23 at the time. I didn't, you know anything. And I said, "No, I don't know." And he said, "Well, you know, the guy premiered the opera. You might want to, you know, he's got a photographic memory. You might want to look at this, you know." And at first, it's so jarringly different from the Carrion. The Carrion is very slow, very pulled out, very very lush. The Toscanini one is so vibrant, so quick. I think the second act lasts under 18 minutes. It is really—
And how long in the Carrion?
It's over 20 minutes. Yeah, it's quite a bit longer. And we played this excerpt here because I think the most glaringly different thing that is just so obvious is in the Carrion recording, Musetta's waltz is extremely drawn out and very slow, very lento. In the Toscanini recording, it actually sounds like a waltz.
No, I think it's a waltz.
Yeah, it's a waltz. And I think I believe the metronome marking is quarter equals 116 or 120. But whatever it is, it's clearly to be done as a waltz. This was the first time I had ever heard anyone do it like that, and it completely, you know, changed my entire thinking about how Puccini is supposed to. You know, people think of Puccini sometimes as this sugary, over romantic, you know, composer, but it's very different than I think the idea that most people get about him, especially when you listen to Toscanini, who knew Puccini, who premiered, I think, three of his operas. You know, it's a completely different Puccini than we're used to hearing.
Well, as three people whom our listeners know well from this program, if not from elsewhere, have each said with almost exactly the same words, and speaking of Philip Gossett, Harvey Sachs, and Riccardo Muti, it's amazing what can happen if you actually read the score.
That's so true.
Now, you still have to have some skill.
Sure.
But so much of what happens in the license taken by conductors, which they might be entitled to take over time in their careers, but so much of it happens because people have not sat down and started from zero with the score.
Yeah. If people did with the pitches what they do to his metronome markings, you would have riots. I mean, people sometimes, you know, I understand that tempo is fluid. It depends on the singer, depends on the situation, depends on the orchestra. But there's no excuse from going from quarter equals 112 to quarter equals, you know, 50. There's just no reconciling that whatsoever. At that point, you're doing a complete rewrite, as far as I'm concerned.
You're in an all-terrain vehicle going over uncharted land rather than driving in a nice car on the road.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with my training and upbringing as a composer, where, you know, I used a metronome as a tool just as I used everything else. And if I wrote, you know, quarter equals 60, I meant quarter equals 60 to, you know, to the best of your capabilities.
So let's talk about your background, which includes, as you said, both being a composer and a conductor. You came to our attention because the Schulte Foundation USA, founded by Lady Valerie Schulte, where she still serves as honorary chair and godmother, I guess we could say, gave you the 2007 award, a fellowship, which allows you to do whatever you want, and we'll talk about what you're doing with that, and also gives you some additional attention. And one of the great things about Valerie Schulte, and there are so many, is that she is one of the least pushy people that I know. And even though she has strong opinions and she knows people and she cares passionately about the art, particularly the art of conducting and singing and young performers in opera, she doesn't push a lot. But she did say to me, I'd love it if you could talk to Tony Barresi, and I'd love it if you could check him out. Because unfortunately, the timing of your award was such that you were conducting or preparing an opera, and you couldn't come back to Chicago for that. And your wife graciously accepted the award for you. Did she cash the check too, or did she let you have it?
Yeah, I think it's in a mutual
thing. Okay. So we don't say no to Valerie Schulte, but it's like Philip Gossett's Good Housekeeping seal. It's a very good seal to have. But you're from Chicago. You're from Melrose Park. You're a good Italian-American kid who's now making it in the conducting world. And you've just been appointed music director and principal conductor at Opera Southwest in Albuquerque. You've been assistant conductor at Dallas Opera. You've had a lot of experience in Sarasota and overseas. How did this all come about?
All my training is in composition. My conducting training stops kind of – I took a college class once in conducting and, you know, it was like three people. You know, I would conduct two people and then, you know, it was a very small class. It was very good. I learned the basics. The teacher, Scott McPherson, was fantastic. But I always just conducted my works and I conducted the works of other composers. And I went to Milano after graduating New England Conservatory, after receiving my master's degree, to study composition.
I have to ask this just because you're local. Where'd you go to grade school? Where'd you go to high school?
I went to grade school.
To New England Conservatory of Music.
I went to grade school in Jane Addams, which is in Merrill's Park, kindergarten through eighth. And then I went to Medfield High School in Massachusetts. Did my undergraduate work at a school called Trinity University in San Antonio, and then went to NEC for grad work.
Okay.
And then at the very end of NEC, I was awarded what is I call the best kept secret at NEC, which is the Frank Huntington Beebe Award. It's an award. It's kind of like a Fulbright, but it's an award only for NEC students. And nobody knows this award is given out. There's absolutely no advertisement for it. My composition teacher knew about it, and so he encouraged me to apply for it. And I got that. And the whole idea was to go to Italy to study composition. And I was going to study with a protege of Berio, whose name is Luca Francesconi, who's making a huge name for himself right now in Italy. And when I got to Italy, his career was kind of really taking off. So he didn't have as much time for me as I needed. And so I found myself stuck in Milano for a year, needing to find something to do.
Oh,
poor
so
me.
Sad. You know? Poor you.
So I enrolled in a contemporary conducting class with Maestro Sandro Gorli, and we did everything from the Ligeti Piano Concerto to Boulez's Le Marteau sans Maître. We did a bunch of chamber-style contemporary music that was very, very difficult. At the same time, a very small opera company was starting in Milano called the Felix Company, and they did opera kind of on a
–
the guy Felix Latronico was the impresario, almost like a storybook Italian impresario, did everything on a shoestring budget, kind of got together an orchestra of 20-something people. And a friend of mine, a guy who knew a guy, you know, typical kind of thing, they said, we need someone to conduct our Bohème. And I thought, you know, knowing nothing about anything at this point, well, how hard can this possibly be, you know? I knew Bohème since I was a little kid. My father played opera records, you know, growing up. I knew opera. And I just didn't really know what I had no idea what I was doing. I was in so over my head. But somehow I made it through that performance, and then we did subsequent performances. And then we did a Barber, we did a Cavalleria Rusticana. That summer, I did another Bohème production. So I kind of started getting the ball rolling there. And I came back to America thinking I'm such a hot shot. Everyone's going to want to hire me, you know. And I couldn't find a job to save my life. And so I ended up teaching middle school for a year, teaching
where?
In Sharon, Massachusetts, teaching chorus with sixth grade general music, seventh grade chorus, and eighth grade theater. And it was a very trying time. I got out of there after a year. I was an intern at Glenbrook.
But after working with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, you were prepared to work with professional
after
musicians.
Working with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, it was they're the most brutal audience you'll ever.
Nothing will ever match
they
that,
they just
right?
don't care. They are so unimpressed by any. I could have, you know, did handstands and they wouldn't have cared. So I became an intern at Glimmerglass. I went to Kentucky Opera and was a rehearsal pianist for their young artist program. Yeah, in Louisville. And then I went to Sarasota, and that Sarasota is where I really began to grow as a conductor. The maestro there, Victor Dorenzi, had me as his assistant for 2 years. The third year I was there, they gave me a performance of Tosca. The fourth year I was there, they gave me an entire production for Lakmé. And then my last year there, I did the production of Marriage of Figaro. So that really helped to catapult me. And then I moved on to Dallas. I moved on to other things. But Sarasota was really one of the first big things.
Well, let's listen to some more music that had an influence on you as a composer, but as we've just heard, composition and conducting are wisely married in your training and background, and I'm sure in the way that you think about doing each of those sides of things. And it's perfectly fitting, of course, that this is from another Italian, but it's also a work that is extremely American. And we should say that on the day we're recording this, a few days before airing this, is the exact 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's speech to the March on Washington, known as the I Have a Dream speech in 1963. And so, yes, you've probably guessed by now, this is the movement O King from Sinfonia or Sinfonia, depending upon which side you butter your bread, of Luciano Berio. 1989 recording. Wow, that was a young Ricardo Chailly with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, recorded in the Concertgebouw, with also Electric Phoenix as the vocal group in O King from Luciano Berio's Sinfonia. Anthony Baresi, you say that this was a work that had an influence on you as a composer.
Definitely. My early composition, and I mean early when I was a teenager, it was all informed by Mozart, Tchaikovsky, kind of, Mozart on, the more romantic composers. And I didn't have much of a stomach at that time for contemporary music. I thought Strauss was the most, radical thing that you could possibly do.
Strauss would have appreciated you.
Yeah, he would have. He would have. But really, it kind of went from Mozart to Puccini, and anything before that and anything after that, I wasn't really interested in. And the first time I was in Italy in 1996, my composition teacher, Roberto Andreoni, said, you really need to break out of this. There's a lot of great music written after Puccini. And in one of my first lessons with him at his house, he played me that recording. Mm. And I was just completely blown away. I thought, it's not tonal, but there's a pivot. There's something I can hang on to. There's some weird process going on underneath. Mm-hmm. There's something going on with phonetics. I don't know what's going on, but I'm really fascinated by what's going on. And after that, I just really got into Luciano Berio's music. This piece and this movement of this piece is definitely the first time that I ever really understood the possibilities of what contemporary music could explore in I don't want to say accessible way, because in a lot of ways this is still, very avant-garde, but in a way that kind of spoke to me at the time.
It's very interesting, because even that first reaction that you had says so much, and it's really a succinct way of saying to people, there used to be these courses, what to listen for in music. There maybe need to be, again, what to listen for in contemporary music, because forget about the whole debate, tonal, atonal, yeah. Post-tonal. Mm-hmm. There was a pivot. It had something I could hang on to. There was a process that my mind could mm-hmm. follow. Find the coat hook. Yeah. Now, not every piece has it, but a good piece does.
Yeah,
and then get onto that, and then let the composer take you somewhere, yeah. just as you would with a movie, with a play,
right.
with a work of literature, with a pop song.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody says, yeah, I really like that pop song because it's tonal.
Yeah, no.
Oh, yeah. But wait, you also like this screechy thing? Well, So I think that it's a reminder that there were these debates years and years, decades ago, that we just don't need to enter into. What the question is: craftsmanship, quality, originality, insight.
Yeah. And I think with this piece, from the first note, Berio tells you what to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you listen to, these sforzati, kind of pivots in the horns and the celli and the piano, and these little punctuations kind of guide you throughout the piece, and you know that there's a process going on and that it's accelerating in on itself. And what really fascinates me with Berio, and especially also with Ligeti, is the idea of an underlying process and mm-hmm. something for you to kind of follow, and the idea that this process reveals itself over a period of time. And so, unlike a lot of other avant-garde composers, I think they do this extremely well without betraying, this is why I say this is kind of tonal. You would never mistake this for post-romantic kind mm-hmm. of music. It's not even tonal, it's tertian. It's just mm-hmm. thirds based.
Right.
So it's not even going into that area of tonality, but it is giving you something, like you said, to hook into. And Berio is such a masterful composer because he doesn't need to write about what you need to listen to. He demonstrates what you need to listen to.
Right. And the idea, too, with Ligeti and Berio is it's not music against something. They're aware of all those things. They participated in all of those battles. It's music that's saying something that they're feeling and thinking.
Yeah. And Berio famously, at least for me, defined music as, someone asked him, what is music? And he said, it's anything that anybody listens to with the intention of listening to music.
Right.
I thought that's perfect.
But that's it. Intention, an intention of making it, an intention of listening to something as music. Well, we're going to play a mean game again, and we're going to listen to a piece by Baresi right after Berio. We'll just listen to it, and then you'll tell us about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I would say that that's a contemporary take on the tradition of the madrigal. What did we hear? When did you write it? When was that recorded? And who is singing?
I can answer all of that except for the last one.
Okay.
That was written in, I guess it was 1997.
Okay.
My first year.
You were 22 years old.
My first year at New England Conservatory. Mm-hmm. It was after I had come back from Italy the first time and was exposed to, as I said, the music of Berio, and I had taken a class in madrigals. I was also really into the music of Busotti, Silvano Busotti, and Donatoni, who also explored madrigals in a very contemporary way.
Mm-hmm. And I just happened to hear a world premiere, maybe the most recent work from last year by Salvatore Sciarrino.
Okay.
These were 12 new madrigals. Uh-huh. Interesting. For lyrics, he used haiku.
Oh, interesting.
But in Italian. I mean, translated from Basho into Italian.
These madrigals, with the exception, I wrote a series of madrigals, five madrigals. All of them used text by Petrarca, except for one by Dante. This one was the first one. It was a text by Petrarca. And the idea behind this, as you said, was kind of a contemporary take on a madrigal. So kind of fusing that with what I had learned from the music of Luciano Berio, I wanted to kind of divide. I wanted to explore simultaneously the idea of madrigalisms that is kind of an onomatopoeic way of exploring words and, mm-hmm. and what they and different meanings of words. But at the same time, since madrigals were so imitation-based, I wanted to kind of delve into the idea with imitation. If you have a vocal line doing something and you have another vocal line imitating that, what happens when the second voice kind of starts making a variation on the first voice, mm-hmm. and then the third voice makes a variation on the second voice? At what point do you lose any sense of there being any imitation whatsoever,
right.
and it becomes something completely different? So that was kind of the underlying idea with this. I recorded this at the end of my first year at NEC, which was in 1998. It was a live performance in Brown Hall, I believe. I remember some of the singers. I don't remember all of them.
That's okay. Yeah. But I mean, they were student singers.
These were student singers, yes, with me conducting.
It's interesting, too, because I hear not only what you're specifically describing and analyzing and the Berio influence, but I also hear the Puccini scene that we played earlier, the idea of voices. In the case of opera, the voices also have characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this idea of the voices singing together and yet also breaking apart, mm-hmm. and taking those little cells of Puccini and Wagnerian leitmotif,
right.
and going off in different directions with them and then sort of rejoining,
right.
through the conducting and through the orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I'm not stretching it, but I I think it's an indication of composer as listener. Listener.
Yes. I think that's a good way of thinking of it. And especially the way you said it, kind of these things take on such an independence that there are moments where it absolutely has to come back together because it's become so fractured what's going on, mm-hmm. musically, that by necessity you can only take this idea of variation of imitation so far before it becomes kind of complete chaos, mm-hmm. and then you have to bring it back to a pivot point.
Tell us about the Lakmé.
Lakmé was the first full production that I did at Sarasota Opera. As I said before, Sarasota was really very key in getting my career launched. My very good friend, Corey Ellison, who I always say, mm-hmm. is the reason that I'm in opera at all.
She's a Facebook friend of mine.
Is she?
Yes.
Oh, I got a friend from now.
Okay.
She has introduced me to everybody important that I've ever known. Philip Gossett, Victor Dorenzi, people in
Dallas.
You want
to talk about fairy godmothers. Corey is the fairy godmother
she
of
She is
of
fantastic.
Opera.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so she got me involved with Sarasota. After doing kind of grunt work for a year or so at Sarasota, I slowly moved up from doing surtitles to, you know, to doing coachings. And then they gave me this Lakmé to kind of test me. And it was the first big production that I did at a regional level company. The recording you heard was from 2005. The Lakmé was Eglise Gutierrez, who's making a huge name for herself now, kind of, mm-hmm. all over the world.
Right.
The Nila Conta was, his name was Young Bok Kim, a young Korean bass.
Also having a great career.
A decent career. And
decent
the
career
tenor
so far.
was Eric Fennell, who's also kind of doing a lot, mm-hmm. Here and there. He just did a an opera, I believe, in Madison, up in Madison Opera. And so this was just kind of my first big break, and it was fantastic. I didn't know the opera at all before, except for the duet and the bell song. And, you know, I just delved into this for I had nothing else to do. Right. I had no other jobs. I just studied this for a year.
This also points out something that's so important, I think, in both training and self-training in opera conducting, and that is the importance of all of these many smaller companies all around the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Germans have understood this for centuries, and that's why singers go off there to work and so on. But you don't want to make your debut at the Met in your
in
first
opera.
Performance of an opera.
Yeah.
You want, I mean, I'm not going to name names, but there's a wonderful younger conductor right now whom I have great admiration for in the concert hall, and he's been making debuts of operas at La Scala, and he's been having problems with that. Well, this is why there are smaller companies.
Yeah.
There are opportunities for the singers, the stage director, the audiences who are very discerning because mm-hmm. it is their only live local opera, but mm-hmm. they know as much about things as other audiences do from travel, from radio, from recordings. And you get a chance to work on things and develop your skills, make some mistakes, learn from them, and mm-hmm. then move on to the next thing and then move up a ladder.
Right. I think that's very true.
And Sarasota sounds like it was just a great incubator for you.
Sarasota is perfect because it was on the cusp of – I mean, now it's – they just redid their opera house.
Right.
They're
right.
definitely, as far as regional companies go, a very international company. They have people come
from – I'm not
yeah.
putting these companies
No, I'm just saying
off,
that –
But you're off of
sure.
the radar, too, of some of the right. harsher critics and so on.
Well, for the
Maybe
long
you weren't,
I got,
huh?
I was under the radar of one of the harsher critics.
Okay.
But he liked my Figaro the next year. So
Good.
In any case, it was a really great opportunity because I got to work there and I got to, you know, train under Duranzi, and he gave me the baton for some rehearsals and he would do this and that. And it was really this progression of going from his assistant to doing some rehearsals to doing one performance to getting your own show. And with, as you said, with there's such a difference between, as far as I'm concerned, symphonic conducting and opera conducting. I'm not going to knock either one of them. I find opera conducting very very different, just extremely
right.
different. It's a completely
right.
different skill set. And you will see sometimes at major opera companies, you look at some guy's resume and they've conducted every major symphony orchestra you've ever seen, and they've done like a Merry Widow somewhere
right.
once, you know, and you
right.
think it is such a different skill set. I mean,
right.
I don't.
And vice versa.
Yeah. And we don't see vice versa. You don't
really?
See somebody who's done La Scala and who's done the Met, who's in
okay.
the Lyric.
Yeah.
And
but they might have done a lot of opera rep, but they haven't done all the big houses.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's just a completely different way
yeah.
to conduct. And
yeah.
I think in one of Norman LeBruck's books, he talks a lot about why conductors today are not like they used to be. When people like Toscanini and people like Carrion and even people like Scholti, they learned how to conduct opera first and
right.
then they got into symphonic.
Right.
And he talks about how with opera, you are dealing with minute changes. Your reflexes are so honed because different things happen every night. Somebody has a cold. Somebody comes in late. You have a totally different kind of honed skill set that you can then apply to symphonic music, mm-hmm. I think, in a different way.
It's a very, very, very important point. And it's a too neglected point by too many managers, too many programmers, mm-hmm. and too many younger conductors, I think.
Yeah.
Let's hear where things went a few years later this year when you did have your own show in Dallas, the Dallas Opera, a child of the Lyric Opera of Chicago.
Oh, don't tell them that.
They won't. It's tough luck. But they're getting ready to move into some amazing yeah. directions with George Steele. I'm sure of that. So did you come in to this most recent Puccini full production with a little more, what, I don't want to say confidence because I don't think you were unconfident before, but with, I guess, some more experience and some more additional insight.
Yes. I had previously in Sarasota, they gave me one performance of Tosca mm-hmm. back, I don't even remember, I think it was 2004. And so I kind of, you know, they threw me in the pit, threw me a baton and said, go. And then I got to cover it at City Opera under Maestro John Demain. So Tosca is kind of, it's not my favorite Puccini opera, but it's mm-hmm. one of these operas that I just keep getting thrown at me.
Sure.
And I'm not going to complain. I mean, it's a fantastic
right.
opera. And so in Dallas, the Dallas opera gig came out. I was when I was done with Sarasota, Maestro Stephen Lord, who's also been a very big advocate mm-hmm. of mine, recommended me to Dallas as an assistant conductor. And the first year there, they gave me student performances of Barber of Seville. And then right around Thanksgiving, when I'd been there a couple months, my boss, Graham Jenkins, said, you know, we really would like you to come back next year for the Tosca. And I said, oh, you want me to do the student performances of Tosca? He said, no, we want you to do the whole thing.
Wow. Now, that's a very different thing, leaving aside the responsibility and the attention, yeah. but it's just walking in to cover somebody else's Tosca and or doing a student performance of somebody else's evening production and starting with the first rehearsals right. and going all the way through. It's just a different animal.
It was very different. And what I did last season in Dallas is the first three operas, I was still Maestro's assistant. I was the assistant conductor of the company. Then they went into Porgyland, and then I took a break. And then I kind of refreshed and came back as the conductor, as the guest conductor mm-hmm. for Tosca. And so, yeah, from the day one, I was the guy. And that was and it was one of these things where when I first prepared Tosca for Sarasota, I had nothing else going on that year. So I studied this opera for an entire year. And, you know, it's amazing if you look at something for 8 hours a day, you know, what you're going to learn, you know. And right. so I started that process over again with Dallas. I just looked at this opera for about a year, and I just really built on what I had already learned.
We need to make it clear at this point, and also as we round out the show to talk a bit about things you have coming up, but we need to make it clear that success has very different sets of definitions,
yes.
and particularly in the world of conducting. Mm-hmm. And even with all that you've been talking about and all that you've been telling us about, life is not exactly a 365-day party for a young conductor.
No.
You've got to still hustle for work and hope for opportunities and for breaks and hope that people will listen to you mm-hmm. and see what you're doing. And it's not something that happens automatically.
No, it's not. And before this year, I was lucky to have three gigs a year max. And then with receiving the Schulte Award last November, I have to say that was one of these kind of fairy tale transformation kind of moments where, like, literally the day after your article came out in the Sun-Times about it, people who would not return my phone calls were calling me and offering me work. And it was...
Are you listening, Sun-Times advertisers?
It was absolutely... I mean, besides the huge monetary prize, which is fantastic, the name of the Schulte Award...
$25,000?
Yeah, just... Yeah. Who's counting?
Yeah, right.
it was one of these things where people were just knocking down my door to offer me work out of mm-hmm. nowhere. People who... Mm-hmm. Again, people who weren't returning my phone calls or emails were calling me up and saying, you know, we've been meaning to call you and you know, would you like to do this? And so this year, I am completely booked. Mm-hmm. I've had nothing between... I'd say about April till September. So I've just used the entire summer to prepare for the number of jobs that I have.
And you've never
up.
Conducted in Chicago.
I have never. I've been offered to do something at DePaul a couple times, and it just has never worked out. Mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. dying to do something in Chicago, you know, talking to people about maybe possibly covering some stuff at the Symphony.
You can guarantee ticket sales from Melrose Park.
That is
right?
for sure. That is absolutely for sure.
Tell us two or three things you do have coming up in the next year or so.
Okay. As you said, I was made music director of Opera Southwest. I'll be going down there very soon to do a Flair Mouse. My lovely wife will be joining me. She will be stage managing that show. From there, I'll be making my kind of more official. I'll be doing a Don Giovanni in Fargo after that. And then immediately after that, I do a production of Turandot in Italy and France. It kind of tours from both to both. And then the big news, which I was just kind of given the okay to announce just a little while ago, is in March, I will be doing a production of Tosca again at the Teatro Reggio in Parma.
Wow.
With Marcello Alvarez. So that's and then after that, I do a Don Giovanni at Boston Lyric Opera and make my debut there.
We want to thank you so much for joining us, Anthony. It's really been a pleasure. And his name is spelled Barrese. He's the new music director and principal conductor at Opera Southwest in Albuquerque. He's a Chicago native and looking to be a home-owning Chicago resident again sometime very soon, depending on the market and everything else. I want to thank another great Chicago Italian-American, Matt DeStefano, for making the program sound as good as it does. I want to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm. Visit us on the web, WFMT.com/critical thinking. There'll be a link for Tony Barresi's own website. You can download, you can podcast, you can let us know what you think about the program. You can drop me a line directly, Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, Rentap at AOL.com. I'm Andrew Patner. We're going to go out with Dangerous Banjo. The banjisto is Brandon Seabrook. And we'll see you next week. Don Giovanni in Fargo. I think that I'm already seeing, I'm going to sell this to the Salzburg Festival for their next Don Giovanni concept.
Yes.
I'm real, the wheels are turning.
Yeah, Don Giovanni, you betcha.
Ralph Cramden.